This week's Undisclosed Addendum is brought to you by three great sponsors: The Great Courses Plus, Simply Safe Home Security Systems, and our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. Listen in for the spots later in the show and make sure to support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the addendum. The following program contains some choice language that some of you might find offensive. Please know that we only provide the language in order to give you the full scope of our investigation. We in no way condone the use of this language. Thanks in advance for understanding.
Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and you are listening to the podcast about all things undisclosed. In episode 13 of Undisclosed, Almost Invisible Money, Rabia, Colin, and Susan attempted to follow the money trail in law enforcement's arcane and perhaps purposefully opaque system for rewarding people who come forward with information. And with us today is one of the hosts of Undisclosed, Rabia Chaudhry. She is an attorney, a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and she blogs at splitthemoon.com, but she's also a New York Times bestselling author of Adnan's story. How you doing, Rabia?
I'm good. Hi, John. How are you?
Very well. Very well. Now, a few episodes, I teased a very special event. I was very cryptic about the whole thing, but now I can finally reveal that the event is going to be a live recording of the Undisclosed Addendum podcast in Washington, D.C., November 17th. At New America, and Rabia Chaudhry will be there, and Susan Simpson. I believe Colin will join us via Skype.
Importantly, you will be there, which is the most exciting thing for us.
Oh, yes. I totally forgot. But I'm excited about this. New America is a Washington think tank, and I've always wanted to party with a bunch of think tank eggheads who've been to Happy
Hour. Partying with a bunch of wonks.
Yes, exactly. But mostly, I'm excited to finally actually meet you in person, and Susan, obviously. I've heard that there is some chance of me meeting Mr. Beans at some point, I'm hoping.
I'm totally going to try to coordinate that, yeah, and get some authentic Baksani food into you.
Nice! Oh, I'm so looking forward. And I'm hoping you just aren't struck dumb by my profound baldness.
I'm just happy that I'm not going to be like, I want to be around people who are relatively in my height range. So I don't know, it's like hanging out with like Susan and Colin and feeling like, I just am like a little lump of clay that got left over.
Hey, Wonder Woman was a lump of clay, if you remember her origin story, which I'm sure Colin can fill you in on, because he's the king of those mythical origins. At any rate, also we have with us today W. Kamau Bell, critically acclaimed comedian and the host of the Emmy-nominated CNN series United Shades of America. Kamau is also the host of the public radio show Kamau Right Now, and he co-hosts two podcasts, count them two, Politically Reactive and Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period. But he is not the greatest actor of all time, periods. I have not seen him in a Restoration comedy. I have not seen him do Caveman. I haven't seen him do... There's a lot of eras that he has not done.
We got to get behind that title, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for being here, Kamau.
Well, thank you for having me. And now you're going to have to be a guest on the Denzel podcast just because you've opened up a vein there.
Well, I'm so excited that you are here today. I am a big fan of United Shades of America. One of the things I love about it is it takes a beautifully sort of humanistic view of everything. And you bring your sense of humor to all these, subjects that are obviously very dire and scary. Have you gotten any kind of criticism for that? I mean, on this show, I've gotten some criticism from people saying, hey, this is a very serious situation. Please don't make jokes. Have you experienced that?
Yeah, I mean, you get that from people, but I think that a sense of humor is what helps us move through these difficult times. If you don't have a sense of humor, you can be crushed under the weight of all the sadness. So for me, it's like there's a difference between making fun of something and making fun out of something. So I'm trying to make fun out of things, not making fun of them.
Also with us today is one of my favorite people, Bob Ruff. He is a producer and the host of the Truth and Justice podcast. He previously served his community as a fireman for 13 years and 3 years as the fire chief. He has served as director of fire science at Southwestern Michigan College since 2008. And he is with us here today. Say hello, Bob.
Hey, John. How are you doing?
Very, very well. It's so great to talk to you, man. And now this season of Truth and Justice has been epic. I mean, it started with an investigation into the case of Kenny Snow, who was a prize fighter serving 40 years for two robberies that he may not have committed. But the show has just mushroomed into a look at two infamous murders and a wide-ranging expose of what appears to be rampant corruption and misconduct in Smith County, Texas. So could you give us a quick overview of those cases? Quick, though, because it's super complicated.
Very quickly. Our main case right now is the case of the murder of Eleanora Griffin, who was attacked, found by her cousin in her home, nude, beaten badly, and her throat slit. The neighbor boy was arrested and convicted for that murder. I believe through our investigation has been ongoing for about 7 months now that he is absolutely innocent. And right now we're in the process of narrowing down suspects to figure out who exactly did do it. As Deidre Enright said on Serial, you don't necessarily need to figure out who did it, but you need to figure out who did it. So the Innocence Project of Texas has taken his case through our show, and they're working the legal angles, and we're working the investigation. And the other one was the murder of Linda Jo Edwards, which was the Carrie Max Cook case, which has been noted as the most egregious case of police and prosecutorial misconduct in the country, one of the largest injustices, most notorious injustices in the country. And we're also working on his case right now.
Well, that's just been fascinating, by the way, watching you peel back the layers on that and seeing how that Kenny Snow and Edward Ates and Carrie Max Cook cases are all actually somehow interconnected. That's been remarkable.
Yeah, they all come out of Smith County, Texas, and there's an incestuous thread of police officers and prosecutors and that county that just one leads into the other. And they're all, like you said, they're all interconnected.
So Kamau, actually, I wanted to ask you a question. Have you been able to listen to this season of Undisclosed?
I have listened to this season. I'm not 100% caught up. I have two young daughters. I'm doing the best I can. But yes, I have listened.
What are your impressions so far?
You know, I think the thing that first struck me was the fact that this is a white guy. You know, the guy who thinks about race and racism all the time and the criminal justice system. I was like, look at this, a white guy who's not being treated well by the criminal justice system. And I sort of appreciated that as someone who focuses on a lot of that with black people and people of color in the criminal justice system, that the sort of the lesson is if you're poor and white, it also is not going to work well for you either.
That's been a big part of actually the case that Bob was working on down in Texas. It seems to be because it happened to Carrie Max Cook, who happens to be white, but it's also happening to Ed Ates and Kenny Snow, who are African-American. So, you know, obviously you can't deny the amount of racism that's inherent in the criminal justice system as it stands now. But it's nice to know that. It gets around. it eventually spreads around.
Stephen Avery, right?
Yes, Stephen Avery. In fact, what Bob was mentioning and what he and I have talked about in the past is that the economic distribution of injustice does appear to be a big component, wouldn't you say, Bob?
Oh, absolutely. At least specifically in some of the cases that I've worked. I think Carrie Max Cook on my show, I thought, put it really well when he said that the color, the racism that goes on, at least in Smith County, Texas, is green. It has a lot more to do with your socioeconomic status than your race.
There's also demographic issues, right? Like, I don't know what the demographics are of Smith County, but like where Joey Watkins is and, you know, kind of rural Georgia area, it's a heavily white population. So certainly the potential of somebody who is white, obviously, to be arrested by law enforcement and to have to deal with these issues is much higher because the number of black people are just less there. I mean, so I'm assuming in Smith County, it's maybe something similar. But then you have situations like Baltimore and larger cities where you have more minority population. So I think demographically, you have to look at this phenomenon, too.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Robbie, you're not suggesting that they bring more black and brown people into these counties so the white people are treated better by the criminal justice system.
You know, actually, that's what we were getting at. Yeah,
that is. I'm coming up with a 10-point policy plan for criminal justice reform, and that's exactly never.
Bring in the white
problem
people.
Solved.
But you know, but the vulnerabilities depend on like you know the demographics. So, but I think it's an important point for our listeners. And this was something that actually, when this case came to us, was something that jumped out at me as well because this was a case that first came to Susan. And as a person of color, as somebody who has experienced the criminal justice system, I mean, especially with Nan's case where, you know, you have a witness who's black, you have a defendant who's South Asian, you have a victim who's Asian. There's so many complicated racial dynamics that are happening in this case. I was also kind of like, oh, wow, everybody in this case is white. And I wasn't even sure if I was like completely comfortable with putting in this many resources. But then I realized, OK, that's kind of a really unjust reaction on my end to say, well, to just expect that because he's a white defendant, he should have the resources or he would have a leg up on the system anyways. But I was very cognizant of that. And I thought this will be interesting to see how people kind of react to this issue. We're going to take a quick break now to check in with one of our sponsors, The Great Courses Plus. Now, if I know our listeners, I know that you guys love to learn, and I love to learn. And our team at Undisclosed, we love to find new ways to learn. That's why we're huge fans of The Great Courses Plus video learning service. Because not only can you learn about any topic that interests you, you can learn new skills and expand on hobbies. They've got courses on how to cook, take better pictures, speak another language, play chess. The Great Courses Plus gives you unlimited access to over 7,000 engaging video lectures presented by top professors anytime, anywhere, and from any device. So I want to share one of my recent favorites that I discovered, and it's called Mastering Stage Presence, How to Present to Any Audience. I've done a lot of public speaking in the last decade or so, but nothing like I've done in the last couple of years. And these speaking engagements and requests, they keep coming. And I travel the country and overseas giving talks on all kinds of things from criminal justice to podcasting to social media advocacy and, of course, Adnan's case. So this particular course is extremely relevant to my work, and it's got 24 video lectures taught by Professor Melanie Long, who's fantastic. She teaches you performance triangle, how to build a character, identifying your own unconscious habits, balancing your body when you're on stage, having intention, purpose, character, and basically being able to give a presentation in any setting that will resonate with your audience. So if you've ever had stage fright, if you want to better your performance when you're talking to public audiences, or you just want to be able to present better even in a space like work, guess what? There are techniques that can help you do that. You're not born with these skills. You can learn them, and you can learn them from this course, which is a fantastic lecture from Great Courses Plus. And now Great Courses Plus is offering our listeners a special opportunity to stream hundreds of their courses free for an entire month when you sign up. Sign up to get your free month of The Great Courses Plus by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed, and find courses that truly interest you and start learning today.
This episode of Undisclosed actually went into great depth on the use of rewards and Crime Stoppers tips and these kind of things. Now, wasn't a Crime Stoppers tip also involved in the Kenny Snow case, Bob?
Yes, and we haven't determined officially who received the reward. But yeah, it was again where the police had left it undisclosed as to who called it in. But we did catch in one of the interviews where the police seemed to have let it slip. It was Kenny's boxing manager, Joe Costello, is the one that appears to be the one that called in the tip.
Did you just do the thing where you said the name of the movie in the movie?
That's, yes.
It was a plug.
Yeah. Now, as a layman, I've only come in contact with the criminal justice system tangentially. But, you know, the concept of posting a reward seems simple. You know, it makes sense. It was only listening to the first season of Undisclosed and the Adnan Syed Crime Stopper situation that sort of opened my eyes to the ways that that whole system can be abused. I think to the average Joe, it sounds like a reward makes sense. And apparently the Crime Stoppers system has yielded enormous results. They credit them with more than 500,000 arrests and more than $4 billion in recovered property. But that sounds like it's become basically a huge, almost an industry with no transparency, which is very troubling.
I think that the troubling aspect here is not being able to kind of document, even as like attorneys or investigators who maybe, you know, I mean, there's ways to be able to provide the information to people who are working on a case without publicly outing somebody, because the fear is obviously like you want to protect the identity of a tipster so they don't fear retribution or retaliation from others in the community or whatever. But there should be some documentation. So whether in Adnan's case and Joey Watkins' case, I'm assuming Bob, in your case, we know we are positive, pretty much a reward was given out, but nobody can tell us who got it. Like, not a single agency. Everybody deflects it, which either means that we're just getting the runaround, or it means that literally documentation has been destroyed by the state. And that is really troubling, because that is what opens the door to like abuse in these situations, because anybody can be a tipster and you cannot verify the information. You don't know if this person got like what kind of benefit they got and how that impacted whether or not, like if they testified, whether it impacted their testimony. I mean, it's crazy, because imagine if you've been accused of a crime and you're told, well, we have a person who gave a tip and got a reward, But we're not going to tell you what that tip was or who that person was. Like, how do you defend yourself from that?
Well, it also seems like, would you say that the police have a vested interest in keeping the system this way? You know, obviously it's had a certain amount of success, but it gives them a tremendous tool.
My question is, because after listening to with how the thing worked with Adnan with the money on the line and how it works here, is money a good idea at all? I mean, I understand that it's maybe helped solve some cases, but it, to me, it just seems like it creates more opportunity for people to lie than for people to help. I mean, even when I walk through the streets and see a sign that's like, if you report this crime, we'll give you money. I'm like, should I try to solve this crime? You know what I mean?
Yes, the answer is yes.
Yeah. You know, it just feels like it plays on people's worst selves, greed.
Personally, I think it's fundamentally flawed. I mean, you're offering a reward for someone to come forward with information about a crime, but by definition, you're looking for people that had information about a crime and didn't come forward with it. To me, it just seems like it's a perfect recipe for perjured statements and false statements because, you know, if these were good, upstanding people that wanted to report this crime that they had information on, they would do it regardless of the money. Only being coaxed out by the money is just asking for somebody to do something for that benefit.
And the thing is, like, there is no point at which, unless you completely trust the police officers involved and the prosecutor, if he's in on it or he or she is in on it, there's no way for anybody to, like, vet the veracity of that particular tipster or witness, right? Like, so as defense counsel, I can't be like, you know, if I have a witness in court, I can maybe, you know, like, try to undermine the credibility. I can find information about them. I can point out to the jury that. But in a case like this, where you have these anonymous people that stay anonymous, and you don't even know what that tip is, you have absolutely no way to help make the determination that this is like a person, like, you know, who's credible, whose information is can be corroborated or verifiable. For Adnan's case, what's troublesome to me and also in a lot of other cases is like the phenomena of where you have the police make an arrest, right? And then the tip is used like, even in Adnan's case, the police decided who they wanted, right? February 4th, even before the tip came in, is when we know they first started pulling Adnan's record. So the police kind of decide who they want. And then, oh, wow, lo and behold, we've got a tip. And so I wonder about, like, the collection of evidence and tips and things like that after the police already have determined who their suspect is or have made an arrest. And I feel like that happens, like in Joey's case, where you have no other evidence. In Joey's case, there's no physical evidence. So what the police needed was for people just to say stuff about him.
Well, and it sounds like Georgia has a terrible system, the way that it works. You know, in Indiana, which is very close to me, the Crime Stopper system there, at least the way it's advertised on TV, is that the reward money is payable upon arrest or indictment. Whereas in Georgia, it sounded like at least the state money, they don't pay that out until after the entire appellate process is done. So you're, you know, our whole system is designed around assuming that our police officers and prosecutors are doing their job in good faith. And if you happen to find one here and there that's not, it's just a recipe for disaster. Because you're just asking for that prosecutor to continue to lean on that witness and hold that carrot out in front of them until they get their conviction.
Well, in the Adnan Syed case, to me, obviously, I have no particular proof that the police in any way abused the system, but it's easy to see how an officer could hint to somebody, hey, listen, if you'll help out with this, why don't you call in a tip next week to Crime Stoppers and, you know, you'll get a piece of the reward and you'll help me out. You know, obviously, like I said, I don't have any proof that that's what happened, but the timeline would certainly support that in the Adnan Syed case.
Yeah, definitely. And if you read the book, I think it seems kind of clear, like something like that was highly possible in Adnan's case. And it can be, okay, I mean, in Joey's case, I mean, the fact that you have the nephew of the lead investigator talking about the tip, wanting, like, really pressuring somebody else to help him get the reward. You know, these are really problematic. It makes you wonder, okay, what kind of conversation did he have with his uncle that led him to do this, like, months after the crime, right?
Would the answer be possibly more transparency, that being, like, if a reward is offered, that has to be introduced at trial, and they have to say if somebody, obviously they could retain anonymity, but that somebody was in line to collect it? I mean, would that possibly help the system?
Here's what I think. I think that, you know, kind of along the lines of like kind of good citizenship and the nature of trials being public, if you have actual information about a crime, which to me would seem to suggest that you will then become a witness at a trial, then I don't understand how you can kind of reconcile being anonymous at the same time. I mean, with Anand's case and with Joey's case, I mean, the discussion was, oh, should we give the full names of witnesses who tested? Well, yeah, these are public records. We have to have transparency in the American criminal justice system. Otherwise, we could be like so many other countries where things are kind of terrifying and secret evidence is used and stuff like that. So, yeah, making that one of the stakes that if you're going to come forward, you're going to collect a reward, that it has to be like in the light of day, I think could be helpful. But, you know, I'm sure police and prosecutors would argue against it.
Isn't in general the fact that the cops need to offer rewards sort of an indicator that people don't trust police in general? Just the fact that, like, people aren't calling cops when they have information because they don't really trust the whole system. To me, it feels like if people actually thought they were being policed well and trusted the system, you would want to help the cops just of your own volition. That the fact that there's a number, a dollar amount put on it means you're like, if you pay me, I'll help you.
Well, that's a very good point. But I imagine there's a lot of people just out of apathy. You know, they feel like, well, you know, the police are on it. They're doing their job. I don't need to get involved with this to a certain extent, I would imagine. But you're right. I think, as you pointed out, it's designed to attract an element of people for whom that's important, you know, who may be people who aren't the very best witnesses in those particular situations. Another issue with the Crime Stoppers tips is what happens to the police once they get them. They often result in investigative tunnel vision, where once they've gotten the tip, that's all they care about. And, you know, as we pointed out in Joey Watkins' case, you know, when you're actually posting a reward, it's inherent that there's going to be tunnel vision because you're asking for information that implicates this guy, you know. So it can worsen an already troubling investigative problem.
Yeah, I mean, I would be okay with this system if you could prove to me that having gotten a tip, the police have not halted their investigation of all possible suspects, right? Like, so notwithstanding the tip, if you have, like, other independent evidence that makes you think this person is your suspect, or if you're looking at other suspects and you can show to me that your investigation has continued on other suspects despite the tip, I think then that shows me that the police are really doing a thorough investigation. But the problem, like you said, is that the evidence seems to show once a tip comes in, again, totally unverifiable tip, have no idea why this person's motivated, how much they're getting, why they're doing it, who they are. If all your documentation after that shows that, well, the police only basically focus on one person, that is like where the real trouble comes in. And that's very common.
Now, in this episode of Undisclosed, there was a very lengthy recording of Corey Jacobs trying to induce David into giving information, or at least re-giving information that he claimed to have heard from him before. He's basically wearing a wire and trying to induce him. But we actually got a lot of social media questions about that. We got one from Brioni Watt, who says, I'm beginning to see why the jury convicted. Without the background, I can imagine being totally overwhelmed by the sheer volume of witness evidence. I think I might end up feeling that where there's smoke, there's fire. I sort of buy Corey's comment that the money was a lure to get the other guy to talk to the cops. That's believable to me. It was a great little window into the weird macho gangsta wannabe thing that these guys were doing. But now, was that actually played at the trial?
I don't think that the wire was played, but that's why we need Colin and Susan. I'm not actually sure because I haven't read the trial transcripts fully. I don't believe it was that the actual recording was played at the trial, but certainly his testimony played an important factor. You know, it was him, and it was like this whole host of witnesses that we have talked about in the last two episodes, which actually has been really tiresome even just to go through, where it's like it's all rumor, right? And even here, it's so clear in the audio recording that this guy is not able to get the information that he wants exactly in the way he wants to present it to the police to get this reward, which seems to be like what's really motivating him. But, you know, I want to keep reminding people that this is the evidence. When people have said to us, well, okay, you're talking about this case, but what's the real evidence? This is the evidence. What we are presenting to you is the evidence that was presented against Joey, and this is what got him convicted. Something like this. So imagine what that means. A couple of teenagers who are talking about, or young people who are talking about, you know, getting a reward, being motivated by that, not being able to get their story straight, you know, things just completely contradicting each other. And this is how this young man basically has lost his life, you know, getting a life sentence for this murder. That's the evidence. This is what convinced the jury. It's this cumulative effect of all these witnesses coming and just blowing smoke and blowing smoke.
We also got a couple of comments from social media, one from Marissa Bradley saying, all right, can we just address the elephant in the room with the constant casual N-words? And another one from Monica Storr saying, how many times do they drop the N-word? I can't keep listening. And that was an interesting window into them. And another person asking if that was actually played in court, because that could well have turned them against, obviously, the witness, Corey Jacobs. By the way, I do want to take a moment to apologize on behalf of the producers of Undisclosed. Apparently, they meant to put a language disclaimer before the description of the podcast, but due to an oversight, we're not able to. So obviously, if that word shocked a lot of people, we apologize. I guess I should apologize also on behalf of all white people for ever inventing the word and using it ever.
Thank you.
This is
a good start. This is a good start.
Yes, exactly. I imagine when I open my door, there'll be a rainbow and everything will be better now because that happened.
I'll also take money.
Well, but come out. I don't know if you got to listen to this very latest episode because you're not completely
caught up. Oh, yes, I did. Oh, yeah, I did. My pseudonym is actually Melissa Bradley. I'm the one who wrote that comment. I mean, even as a black guy who uses that word occasionally in my life on stage, mostly when I'm talking about it, I was like, man, this is a lot of N-words. And I listen to independent rap music. You know, I was like, this is a lot. So I'm sure if you're not somebody who hears that word a lot in their life that, if you were just listening to this tape, that you would just think everybody's guilty who's associated with any part of this.
For me, you know, obviously it's awful, and as a white person, I'm mortified. But also, I sort of understood the culture to some extent because, you know, teenagers always create their own sort of transgressive, you know, fuck you grown-ups culture. And I guess we're going to have to put a trigger warning on this episode now that I've said that. And they try to do things that sort of position themselves as outlaws, you know. And obviously they're a fan of rap music because we heard them. By the way, I must confess, I'm embarrassed to admit, I did not know that song.
Thank God. I thought it was just me.
Okay. apparently it's Wannabe a Baller by Lil Troy. I'm much more old school in my hip hop references, so that was news to me.
But also, John, you're already a bowler.
Oh, okay. There you go. Yeah, so I would have no knowledge of that song. But it's not like they live in a town that, you know, this is Georgia. This is not a place that is immune to racial strife. They must have some understanding of it. Is this just part of the culture?
Probably a very long, deep history of racial strife, I'm guessing.
Yes.
You know, I wanted to address this issue with our listeners. You know, as we were recording that episode, Susan immediately, I mean, she was very sensitive to this. She said, you know, I feel like we should censor out this word. We should bleep it, or we should like do something with the audio so it's not, we don't want to offend our listeners. And I think Colin was kind of not sure which way to go on this. I don't remember how he commented on it. But I actually said that I feel like the full audio should be in. And I mean, I would love to hear, Kamau, how you think about this. I'm not like a professional media person. And I don't know exactly like what the ethics of these things are. But for me, as somebody who is a lawyer, I feel like, you know, things should be presented as they are. And, you know, when I talk about, you know, I'm not a black person, but I am a person of color and I have grown up and been called a sand nigger. And I'm going to say like the full word a number of times, even as a child and even as a teenager, I've been called these words. And when I relay those incidences to people to kind of explain to them how anti-Muslim sentiment exists in our society, I want them to feel the full impact of the ugliness of the word. And if I say a sand bleep, a sand N-word, I feel like they're not going to get the punch in the gut that I got, you know, the slap in the face that I felt. So I was like, you know, I want people to be as uncomfortable and as hurt by it as I was in those moments. And that's why I felt that, no, you know what, we should use the audio and we should, because you should be offended. You should be like, what is this crap? And I feel like if you censor all that out, like you're sanitizing things for people. You're making it really easy for them. And I don't want to make things so easy for people. So that's where I stand on the issue. So I take responsibility for not bleeping that out. But definitely a trigger warning, a heads up. That was an oversight. And we apologize for that. But Kamau, I'd love to hear your thoughts on these issues.
Well, first of all, I love the fact that you said the word nigger, but you said the word crap. I love the fact that you... So, yeah, I agree with you. I think that the other thing we have to talk about here is what the podcast is about. The podcast is about helping people who are in jail or have been arrested or have been caught up in the criminal justice system because of things that they didn't do but have been, you know, framed, whatever the word is. So I feel like a little bit, if you're going to hear ugly things, this is the podcast where ugly things are going to be heard. So yeah. It's not like this is what the podcast is. And so a little bit, I feel like I understand that people were offended. But I think we're here to be offended. Like, I think that this is the thing is get offended and then do something. So I feel like, I don't know, I can't think of a podcast where you wouldn't hear it. Maybe This American Life, they would have bleeped it. But I feel like this is not that podcast. This is where we're here to talk about ugly things.
And if I can interject as far as, because I go through the same thing, Rabia, on Truth and Justice. You know, I do a lot of interviews And you know, I interviewed Bill Cole, who was a witness or a victim in the Kenny Snow case. You know, he used the term high yella when I was talking to him. And I just did an interview with Margie Jackson this week, who was Ed's mother, the defendant's mother in the Elmore Griffin case. And there's a lot of foul language. And I was thinking about whether I should take it out or censor it. And my feelings on it is exactly the same as you is, first of all, I think that people need to see, to get a full picture about, you know, what's going on in these people's minds. You know, both of our podcasts are about the truth and getting everything out there. And for us to try to sanitize that, I just don't think it's right. And then I have the other sentiment in my mind is the guys in that recording on your podcast, and we just heard it with Donald Trump. If you don't want people to hear you say something, then don't say it. You know, they said it, so it's going to be out there.
Yeah. And it exists. And people, until they hear it with their own ears, like, I mean, I know people who are like, well, I mean, like, so you're just kind of, oh, sexism, oh, racism. I mean, like, so I feel like, you know, I want you to hear it. So you, if you don't believe me, maybe once you hear it, you'll believe we are not post-racial. We are not post-misogyny. We are not post-patriarchy. Like, these things exist. And you should hear this stuff so you can understand that yourself. But this, yeah, is also an interesting dynamic in this. This is two young white guys talking to each other, right? And so they adopted a language that's, you know, I don't know how they're thinking about these words and what they mean to them, but we've had an interesting reaction from listeners definitely on it.
Well, it sounds like they've adopted it as their language, their patois between each other. You know, like I said, I think they're just trying to sound like badasses, the badasses that have been modeled in rap, I guess. Although, boy, it sounds lame from them.
I was thinking they were trying to sound like dumbasses.
Yes. Well, mission accomplished, fellas.
I would just say they definitely sounded like white guys who don't know a lot of black people.
Yeah. And it brings us back to, I've been meaning to talk to Robbie and Bob about this for a while, because months ago you guys did a dinner with a bunch of, I believe, prosecutors and judges. And the topic of racism in the criminal justice system was raised. And my understanding was that they gave a lot of pushback on it, that they were arguing that it wasn't really a factor in the criminal justice system. Is that accurate?
That was such a surreal experience.
Yeah. I think I got a little more pushback than Robbie did.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know if it was just me, but I felt like the whole audience was, like, slightly hostile. Like, they just felt, especially the tables in the front of the room, which is, like, mostly white prosecutors and attorneys. And for us to be telling them that these are issues, these are systematic issues. And, you know, it was like this almost, like, what? Huh? Well, no, the system corrects for these things. And that's why we have, like, you know, these things in place and the Constitution and blah, blah, blah. And but I also wonder after that event, I mean, like, there was a recent filing in Adnan's case. I'm like, I wonder if this contributed to that, this decision.
Yes, I did want to ask you about that later as well, but we'll get to that.
My favorite was the prosecutor, the white prosecutor in front of the room, telling us that I've said that, you know, 95% of the time prosecutors get it right, or 90% or whatever the number was. And she's like, so that's only, you know, 5%. So what's the big deal, was basically what she was saying. You know, that we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people that have been wrongfully convicted and these racial motivations that are out there in the system. And she was saying that, you know, 5% is, that's pretty good. It's fine. What's the problem? Stop talking about it, basically, is what she told me.
If I may speak for white people, part of the problem is there are dual definitions of racism. You know, if you look it up in the dictionary, it just says having the attitude of racial superiority. But people of color understand it to mean an entire system that has the effect of racism. And that is why white people can sort of buy out, because if they can personally say to themselves, well, I don't have that attitude, it allows them to sort of buy out from ever agreeing that racism is involved in the system. So, you know, that's message from white people.
How do you define racism? Kamau, how do you define racism?
I mean, I do think that we have to talk about, like you said, John, the dictionary definition versus the actual definition. And when we're talking about America's racism, we're talking about the power to make people's lives worse through structures and institutions. Hating somebody isn't enough. You actually have to have the power to make their life worse.
It's very frustrating for me to, you know, read arguments on social media and stuff like that, because to me, I just, all those arguments end up coming back to the difference in definitions, because I can say people get so, by the way, this is all people, not just white people, but they get so angry when they feel like they're being labeled racist or part of a racist system. And they take it so personally because they, you know, on a daily basis, probably try to be fair and not have racist attitudes. Of course, there's, you know, a fair number of people who are out and proud about it. But I just wish people could underscore that we're not talking about the same thing. It's very frustrating to me.
Oh, it's more frustrating to us. People of color.
Don't you guys understand that John and I are really struggling with this?
Yes, exactly. Can't you feel our pain?
Yeah, I have
been struggling. Everybody relax. I've been struggling.
Good, struggle, be uncomfortable. I mean, like, that's the whole thing there. One of the most fascinating things to me with the Don's case and all of these different issues, I mean, even when you look at, like, you know, videotaped evidence of police brutality against Black men, and you still have this whole contingent of people saying, what do you mean, right? Like, it's remarkable that people cannot see or accept the narratives of an entire community telling you the same thing over and over, providing evidence of it. And so it's very much, I mean, you're talking about definitions, and I think it's also about self-preservation. I think it's about feeling very defensive. And because if you are to accept it, what does that mean about you? Like, what are you now going to do about it? And how are you implicated in it? And so it's easier to say, well, no, it was just that guy was just like not cooperating with police. You know, it's easier to dismiss something and not have to take responsibility or have to really think and be troubled by these issues.
And tribal loyalty comes into it. You know, one wants to honor the police, and obviously the police have a very hard job, and, you know, but they're at completely different levels of professionalism. Obviously, there's fantastic police and there's police who shouldn't be there, you know. But I think what you were mentioning is that the tendency to just dismiss these things as one-off experiences, you know, it's like, oh, we're not seeing the tape where the cop did the right thing. You know, we're not seeing those videotapes. You don't see those go viral. Every now and then you see something that's heartwarming. You'll say, oh, here's a cop with a puppy. You know, it's like, oh, he saved a puppy from a tree. You know, but the rest of them are horrible and alarming. And I, for one, you know, that has transformed my understanding of how these interactions are happening just on a personal level.
Hi, Undisclosed fans. So a couple weeks ago, I told you about SimpliSafe Home Security. This past weekend, I installed SimpliSafe in my home, and it is exactly as the founders of the product describe it, simple. And I'm really not trying to be cute by using a part of the product's name in my description of it. Installing SimpliSafe Home Security in my home was honestly one of the most simple things I have done in a long, long time. It's basically plug and play. Literally, like, you plug the base system in, you stick up the attachments, and the system goes to work almost automatically. I set up a full home security system in less than 30 minutes, and it works wonderfully. So listen, if you don't have SimpliSafe, but you do have a home security system, it's possible that you're getting ripped off. That's because you're likely stuck in a contract situation with no way out. It's robbery by contract, and it can cost you thousands of bucks. Look, SimpliSafe is a better way. SimpliSafe has no contracts, none. You're getting award-winning 24-hour, 7-day-a-week protection, named the best in the industry. It's just $14.99 a month. That's less than half what most companies charge. So protect your home the smart way. Visit simplysafeundisclosed.com. Go right now and you'll get free shipping on your order and a free keychain remote. It only takes a minute. That's simplysafeundisclosed.com.
I don't know if our listeners know, if you and Bob know, that Kamal is like on a tour right now, and I would love to hear about the show that he's doing. I'm really excited because I'll get to see him perform live this week in D.C. But what I've been told is that, Kamal, your show is like one of the most insightful kind of commentaries on race in America today. I would love to hear a little bit more about the show, like your material, you know, your angles and the response.
I've been doing comedy for a while now, and it's just very clear to me, as much as people say my show is insightful, it's really that people are really needing to hear this now, that we are in a very critical time in this country. And so I can tell the difference by, after a lot of shows, we'll do a Q&A, and it used to be like 3 or 4 years ago, I'd say Q&A, and people would leave. And now, after every show, people are like, yes, I have many more questions. I have many more questions. Like, you know. And so that there's just really a need for people to hear people talk directly about the race and racism in this country. And so I think I've been talking about it for a while, but I think people are ready to do something about it. And people are ready to engage with it in a more direct way. And that even includes good white people like John.
even good white people like me. Well, I try. Now, where is the tour going, by the way? This is a beautiful opportunity to announce some dates, Kamal.
You guys with your setups and plugs. Thank you. It feels very awkward to plug your tour on this podcast, by the way.
No, please do it. No. I don't want people to miss this opportunity.
Yes. I mean, I will be in Washington, D.C. this Thursday. I'll be in New York City this Friday. And I'll be in Boston on Saturday. And then I'll be in Portland the following week. But more than that, I'm actually doing a lot of shows at colleges. If you go to my website, wkimelbell.com, that's where the real work is being done, is these college shows where I talk about ending racism and about an hour. And that's the generation who's super fired up and is super ready in ways that I haven't seen before. And I've been doing colleges for years. So I'll be doing a lot of colleges for the next few months or until racism's over.
You've got 3 months, Kamel.
Yes, exactly.
That's awesome.
Well, it is interesting because, you know, I have a 16-year-old son, and the amount of exasperation that he expresses at the state of racial issues in the United States, he's just so tired of it and unhappy with it. And they just want this stuff to be over, honestly. But unfortunately, the United States has done a terrible job. You know, there was no reparations. There was no reconstruction. I mean, it was terrible. We've done a terrible job of fixing this. You know, there's still laws on the books, a horrifying vestigial remnant of this. And I told this to my son to sort of illustrate the ghost in the machine of racism that's still in the system. Is I bought a house years ago, and on the deed was a listing that it could not be sold to Negroes. This is a house in Los Angeles. This is California, a place that, you know, does not have the well-known history of racial strife, although it was absolutely here. You know, tell that to the Mexicans and the Indians that were here. But I was trying to give him, you know, this is the home you grew up in, kid. You were here till you were 4 years old, and that was in the deed. You know, obviously there was a law that struck it down in the 50s, but it took till the 50s for a law to come out and say that that was illegal. So, you know, as I said, I think kids today are just, they're sick of hearing about it. They want to help and finish it. And I wish them Godspeed. That's for sure.
You went like white Malcolm X for a second. I appreciate that.
Sorry, it was shocking to me. Because I was actually just going through the document just to see, you know, because I was selling the place. So I was like, oh, it's fascinating. You know, the place was built in 1937. You know,
I always wonder about where the weight of change comes from. Like, you know, sometimes it has to be legislated. It has to have the enforcement of law. But on the other hand, sometimes the legislative changes like don't come about unless there's like a big public shift in sentiment. And I always wonder if like which way it has to be. Do we as human beings need to just like be legislated to the extent of like you simply cannot describe, and like is that what corrects our behavior? Or are we like inherently like capable of having kind of internal and ethical mechanisms that say, okay, as a society, we're just going to move to a place now where it's no longer acceptable in our society. I think, you know, if you look at, for example, issues of anti-Semitism and homophobic sentiment, I think, I'm not saying there's no such thing as anti-Semitism or homophobia. Obviously, these things still exist. But there has been much more success in making these things very not palatable, right? Like we react very strongly when we see these things in the public discourse, whereas racism against Black people, I think racism against people of color in general, there's still a little bit of leeway. Not a little bit. There's a lot of leeway. I mean, you know, you can look at the presidential election and see it. But
I mean, I do think that sometimes it does have to be legislated out. I mean, look at marriage equality. Like the country was maybe about 50-50 at that point, or 51-49 for marriage equality. And the Supreme Court did it just to sort of get us over the hump. You know, like it just felt like and they did it and now it's it. And I feel like I don't know if I would have been comfortable waiting for the country to vote against slavery. You know, I think sometimes it is up to the legal system to, you know, when it works well, to lead the country into a better place. So not to say you can rely on it, but certainly I think that, like, if I had to wait on voting out slavery, I'm pretty sure I'd have a different life right now. So word to Abe Lincoln.
Basically, people suck. That's
yeah.
You can't rely on public opinion.
Guys, I have to go. I don't know how this works, but I have to move on to this.
Well, thing. We thank you for being here. It was such a pleasure. Do check him out if he's on the road and in the many colleges he is visiting. Ladies and gentlemen, Kamel Bell. Woo! We have no studio audience. We have nobody to clap.
Thank you so much for being on, Kamel.
Thank you. Come on.
Thank you. I'll see you Thursday, Rabia, and I'm going to go buy a new computer. Thanks, everyone.
Okay.
Awesome. It's time to check in with another sponsor of ours, Blue Apron. Now, Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everybody. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals right to your door every single week. Now, if you're like me, a home cook who's been doing it for years but gets tired making the same old stuff over and over again, or you've never touched a stove, Blue Apron will work for you because everything they send you is exactly in the amounts you're going to need. You're going to have these beautiful step-by-step instructions on how to make these dishes that end up looking really like they came out of a gourmet restaurant. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron only delivers the best because the food's not just delicious, but it's organically and ethically sourced. They have established partnerships with over 100 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. So stop wasting money at fast food meals, because you know what? They actually end up costing more than Blue Apron meals. And not only that, but you know what? Cooking together builds strong families. So you can bring the whole family around the kitchen, give everybody their task, cook together, and sit down to a delicious home-cooked meal 3 to 4 times a week. And some of the meals available in October, listen to this, crispy chicken Milanese with warm Brussels sprouts, celery and potato salad, Thai green curry chicken and squash with yo choy, jasmine rice and cashews, and seared salmon and fall vegetable hash with apple brown butter dressing. Yeah, sounds like fall is here. And that's because Blue Apron is constantly changing its rotation of recipes. They're all seasonal. You get new recipes weekly. They're never repeated within the year. And you can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. You just go into your account and you choose delivery options you want. You choose the meals that you want. There's not even a weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/UP. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/UP. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Considering that there was an amicus brief filed in Anand's case filed by the Maryland trial lawyers a while ago, and actually we didn't comment on that on the addendum. Rabia, what is the purpose of amicus briefs?
So an amicus brief is a brief filed by a third party to a court that is a party that has some concern about the issues that are being litigated in the court, but are not a direct party, right? So, you know, if you have a case in which there's, like, let's say medical malpractice, maybe, like, there'll be other kind of consumer groups that might file an amicus. Amicus means, like, friend of the court. And so what happened was a few weeks ago or a month ago, actually the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, a national association, filed an amicus in Adnan's appeal, basically saying that, you know, they support Adnan's right to get a new trial, that he deserves a new trial, that the circuit court's ruling was proper, and that the Court of Special Appeals should not entertain the state's appeal, because the state basically doesn't want Adnan to get a new trial. They want the Court of Special Appeals to overturn Judge Welch's ruling. What happened last week, I thought that was remarkable. I didn't know that was going to be in the works. I had no idea it was coming. And then I thought what was even more remarkable was that about a week ago, a state level, almost every state's attorney from every county in Maryland came together to file an amicus supporting the prosecution and saying basically the same thing, which is that Adnan should not get a new trial, that overturning of the conviction should itself be overturned, and that he made an error in his ruling. And when I saw that, I sent Justin a message, Justin Brown, Adnan's attorney, and I was like, does this happen in cases? Have you ever seen this? And he's like, no, but like this is a case like no other.
Yes. That keeps coming up. That quote just keeps coming up for some reason.
It's a really weird move. It's a really interesting move. And I think it was mostly a PR move. What Colin pointed out, really, he's written a couple of blog posts on this, and I encourage people to check them out because they're really fantastic, is that this kind of this group of prosecutors, this posse of prosecutors who are running to, you know, the state's attorney's aid, have cited no law. No case law, nothing. It's just like a big kind of a propaganda piece. And on top of that, they're reciting facts to the court that actually are not true, which is something like I can't wrap my head around how they can keep getting away with this.
Well, and also they're facing an enormous uphill battle to begin with, because my understanding is an appeal is inherently an abuse of discretion case in this particular situation, because they're appealing a judge's ruling. And judges are given wide discretion to make these kind of rulings. They're allowed to. He cited relevant case law. It appears, you know, from all appearances that he did a very good job in buttressing his case for why Anand deserved to have his conviction vacated. So it puts a huge burden on the people appealing that, because they have to appeal his abuse of discretion, that he's done something wrong as a judge. So what you're saying is that they have given a document that is attempting to buttress the evidence in the case, but in not in any way disputing the discretion of the judge, which is the whole point of an appeal.
Right. They've made no legal arguments. Yeah.
So again, I guess it lays bare that it is completely a PR move, because, as I said, judges don't want to overturn other judges.
And the other reason that it is a real uphill battle for the state right now is because they are making their appeal to the same court that sent the case back down to Judge Welch to take into consideration Asia McClain, right? So this is a court that has already looked at the case, decided that it needs to go back to Judge Welch. I mean, Judge Welch could not have made another determination if this court hadn't sent the case back to him. So they are really kind of, that's another reason that it's going to be very hard for them to win the appeal. And I'm pretty sure that they are not going to be honest. But it is a heck of a PR move. And when I saw that, I thought back to the presentation Bob and I gave, and I was like, I wonder how many of them were in that room that night.
I say? So we got a social media question from Iva T saying, why is this second season saying so little, if anything, about Joey's lawyers, both trial and appellate?
So we actually do have episodes lined up that's going to say a whole lot about Joey's lawyers, about his defense in both the trial and appeal, especially because people might not be aware, but the one law firm that defended Joey was a very high profile law firm in Georgia that, you know, his family was able to bring on board. And so we're talking about the law firm of the gentleman who the character Matlock was modeled after. So we have a lot to say about this firm and the folks who defended him. And, you know, they've been very cooperative with us. We actually went down to the firm and went through the files and everything, and very helpful. But don't worry, we have more episodes lined up to talk about that stuff coming soon.
So, Bob, as you know, I've been riveted to the Truth and Justice podcast this season. So where is this case going? Do you have any idea?
No.
I got nothing.
Well, I mean, we were really thrown for a loop a few weeks ago when I was able to track down an interview who I kind of considered to be the prime suspect. And as you heard, Mr. Leonard Mosley either was telling the truth or he's a phenomenal liar. And you know, I'm sitting in my office now looking at my suspect board, and I see all of these items in Leonard Mosley's category that seem to point to him, but I can't ignore the fact that his interview really seems to, I even had Stanley Burke, who is with the FBI, Jim Clemente put me in contact with him. You know, you saw him on the JonBenet Ramsey special. Stanley listened to it and said, you know, I just don't hear any signs of deception there. So now I'm at a point where we're really starting to take a hard look at every single other suspect, because I don't want to get caught in the trap of that confirmation bias where, you know, I've already put blinders on and made my mind up that it's one person. You know, this past week, I even interviewed Ed's mother, Margie Jackson, as a suspect. My opinion after looking into her for the last week is that she had no involvement. But so where we're going now as far as my end on the investigation is we're just at this point going point by point by point, person by person, and looking at all the different suspects in depth. But from the legal perspective, you know, I work with the Innocence Project of Texas has taken his case. I think we've got a really good shot of getting Ed out. There's something I can't really talk about and disclose what the legal strategies are, but we're very confident that we can get Ed a new trial. But the focus then shifts back to me on is to find true justice is not just to get Edward Ates out of prison, but to find justice for Elnora Griffin. So that's where we're going, is to continue to go suspect by suspect by suspect until we figure this thing out. Kenny Snow's case is looking pretty good, too. His is a little more difficult because, you know, there was no trial with Kenny. You know, he got bullied by the detectives and was lied to by them. We had this kind of, what sounds like a false Crime Stoppers tip. And so Kenny ended up confessing in order to protect his girlfriend at the time, and pled out. So there's not a lot to work with on him, but what we do have there is the fact that the actual victim in the case, who was not happy that I contacted him originally, I mean, when I first contacted him, he was, you know, his exact words were, yeah, I remember that motherfucker, that boxer. But then when I started going through the case with him, has come around and said, you know what, I don't think this is the guy that did it. And yeah. So we're working on right now, you know, we have through our crowdsourcing, we have an attorney in Texas that has taken Kenny's case pro bono and is working at the moment to meet up with Bill Cole to get a signed affidavit for him to try to get Kenny Snow's case back into court as well. So on the legal perspective, both cases are looking pretty good at this point. As far as the investigation goes, they were looking really good like 2 weeks ago. And now I'm just kind of scrambling to kind of reset. And it's almost like starting back from zero. You know, Laura Richards, you know, who works with Jim Clemente and is on the Real Crime Profile podcast with him, was a former Scotland Yard profiler, is currently analyzing the case and working a profile for me. I couldn't have Jim do it because Jim is a listener and knows too much about the case to do an unbiased profile. So Laura has been nice enough to take that over for me. So we're, you know, we're still plugging away at it until we figure this thing out.
Well, in the meantime, the podcast is riveting, just so you know.
No, well, thank you. I appreciate it. Did you get a chance to listen to Margie's interview?
No. I was listening to Kamau's podcast yesterday.
I've got a lot of catching up to do because of my travel and stuff. But
the Mosley interview, yeah. They're great interviews, and they unfortunately create more questions than they answer, but they're fascinating to listen to.
Margie is something. I have to say that Margie Jackson was probably my favorite interview I've ever done. I don't want to give too much away, but you'll enjoy it. It's intriguing, and it's disturbing and hilarious all at the same time.
So check out the Truth and Justice podcast. I also wanted to comment on something. Last week, I gave Colin some shit about just his incredible use of references. Is just remarkable. And in this particular episode, he just went crazy with a virtuoso display. He cited the Gospel of Matthew, Shakespeare's Henry IV Part II, Jim Butcher's The Dresden Files, Mark Miller's Marvel miniseries Civil War, and the John Ford movie The Informer. So, folks, this was just Colin's way of saying, come at me, bitch. He was saying, go ahead, John. Go ahead. Make fun of it.
That was a middle finger directly to you, John. I just want you to know that. And, we discussed it.
I'm just going to say, Colin, message received. You win.
He is like an encyclopedia, and I can't remember my younger daughter's birthday. So this is like the difference in information that he's able to store versus me. It's pretty amazing. I have to often look up what he's talking about.
Well, thank you guys so much for being here for this. It was a blast, and I hope to see you guys both shortly.
All right.
Thanks so much, John and Bob.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening to another episode of The Addendum. As you probably know, I've been highlighting organizations that help the wrongfully convicted on these shows. And this week, what I'd like to do is tell you a story. In 1985, John Thompson, a 22-year-old father of two, was wrongfully convicted of murder and sent to death row at Angola State Penitentiary in Louisiana. While facing his seventh execution date, a private investigator hired by his appellate attorneys discovered scientific evidence of Thompson's innocence that had been concealed for 15 years by the New Orleans Parish District Attorney's Office. Thompson was released and exonerated in 2003 after 18 years in prison, 14 of them isolated on death row. The state of Louisiana gave him $10 and a bus ticket upon his release. He sued the district attorney's office. A jury awarded him $14 million, one for each year on death row. But when Louisiana appealed, the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. This spring, Justice Clarence Thomas issued the majority 5-4 decision in Connick v. Thompson that the prosecutor's office could not be held liable. The controversial and divided decision leaves Thompson with no choice but to get on with his life, which, incredibly, he already has. He is the founder and director of Resurrection After Exoneration, an organization that provides transitional housing to exonerees in the New Orleans area. RAE has created a comprehensive reentry program for exonerees and other formerly incarcerated individuals, partnering with local businesses, nonprofits, professionals, and volunteers. In addition to providing multiple direct services, RAE also positions exonerees as advocates and voices for change in the criminal justice system. And you can reach RAE on the web at r-a-e.org. And actually, that organization came to you courtesy of Methil Telhan, sending me a story about them. So thank you, Methil. Fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #justiceforjoey. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use the #UDaddendum, or you can tweet them directly to me at @MrJohnCryer. Also, again, if you've got any worthy organizations, we're running out of runway here, so now is the time if you'd like for me to consider donating to and highlighting them on the show. And as always, there'll be new case documents and photos posted at undisclosed-podcast.com. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod. And also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project at GA Innocence. I'm going to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime for our audio production. I'm going to give a shout out to Patrick Cortez once again for composing the new addendum theme. And Methil Telhan, again, is our project manager, and she does it so well. And I want to remind our audience, November 17th at New America in Washington, D.C., I will be there, Robbie will be there, Susan will be there, and Colin will be there via Skype. So if you can go to newamerica.org, you go to their events page, and you can register for that event, and we would love to see you there. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again soon. My only other thought is I've decided that the title of this whole season of Undisclosed should be Corey Has No Chill. That was my favorite moment of the thing. That was the understatement of the year from Susan Simpson. It was much appreciated.